This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If we don't change direction, we're going to end up where we're headed.
What would an economy built on principles of fairness and sustainability look like? How do we model it? Where is it emerging? How do we collectively strategize to fully implement it? These are the questions that will be asked at the upcoming Strategies for a New Economy conference, hosted by the New Economics Institute. Sea Change Radio founder Bill Bowie serves as this week's guest host, speaking with two leading environmental thinkers who will be participating in the conference. First, Bill talks to Gus Speth, a law professor at the Vermont Law School and the former dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. They discuss the problems with GDP-based economic growth strategies and how we might be able to look beyond striving for endless growth in a world with finite resources. Next, Bill speaks with Will Rapp, the founder of both Gardner Supply and the Intervale Center, about the struggle to create systems change from the bottom up, as well as using the state of Vermont as a model for rebuilding our economies.
Gus Speth, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, delighted to be talking with you, Bill.
Gus, the most recent editions of Orion Magazine include your two-part piece, America the Possible, a manifesto, and it lays out a vision that aligns with the work of the New Economics Institute, whose board you serve on, that's also being explored at the upcoming Strategies for a New Economy conference. Now, let's start with your author's note. You say the case for the transformation of today's American capitalism into something truly sustaining for people and planet rests on two related propositions, systems failure and a better world. So let's just start with the first one, systems failure. What systems and how are they failing?
Well, if you look at the, as I did in this a book, America the Possible, that's coming out in September, at where the U.S. stands relative to the other advanced industrial democracies. So you take a selection of 20 countries, and then you look at 30 different, as I did, at 30 different indicators of national well-being, you find that the United States is at the very bottom of that list. In environmental issues, social issues, economic issues, political issues, we're at the bottom now of the OECD countries, except for the new countries that have joined the OECD lately. So I think when you have encompassing problems across such a broad spectrum, the only real conclusion you can come to is that it can't be due to small reasons. It's got to be due to the fact that the system itself is failing us. And it's a system of political economy. It's not just the way the economy set up. It's the combination of our, you know, political impacts on the economy and the way the economy is managed by the political process and affected by it. And this system has a lot of problems. It's giving an overwhelming priority to economic growth, even at the expense of a host of other things. And growth, meanwhile, is not delivering on its intended promises. We've had tons of growth in our country over the past several decades, and you know, while jobs fled our borders, life satisfaction flatlined, poverty and inequality mounted to, you know, levels we haven't seen since before the New Deal, and environment declined, all in related to the pattern of growth. And in that regard, we have failings in the way our corporations are structured. We have our own failings in our addiction to this consumerism that we are all party to. And on down a list of challenges, but if you add these factors up, what you have is a system of political economy which is not delivering. And I think this is one of the first things that the New Economics Institute has got to focus on, is presenting this message. You know, I think people appreciate that the country is not performing well across this broad front. We've got to help people understand that this broad encompassing pattern of failure is really a system failure. It's due to the type of economic and political system that we have. And so if we want to deal with these problems, we've got to change the system. And we know a lot about how to do that. We don't know everything we need to know, but we know enough to get started, I think.
Just sticking with the system's failure for one moment before we go on to the brighter vision of a better world, you focus a lot of the attention on growth, economic growth as a kind of blind faith, or what the neoclassical economists really say will solve all problems. Are you anti-growth, or what is the solution to a system that's predicated on growth that still provides for all of our needs and basic well-being?
Well, growth certainly isn't doing that today. There are a lot of things that do need to grow, mind you, but when I talk about growth failing us, I'm referring to GDP growth. If you look at that, it's back up to where it was before the 2008 recession began. And yet we still lack 10 million jobs. We have a very high unemployment rate, vast poverty, unprecedented numbers of people on food stamps, and persistence of the greatest inequality in the rich industrial world, and lowest social mobility. So this growth that we worship, so this growth fetish, isn't really delivering. We ought to move to what I refer to as a post-growth society, one where the ultimate priority isn't just to grow the economy, but to provide decent livelihoods for people, to sustain our communities, to sustain the environment. That ought to be the reasons why we have an economy, to sustain and improve the people, place, and planet. If we focus there rather than on profit and power and production, which is where we're focused now, then if some growth occurs, well, fine. We if it doesn't occur, well, fine. It's just not the priority. And that's how we need to envision the role of the economy. It's a new paradigm, a new way of thinking about what economic activity is all about.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and you're listening to guest host Bill Bowie speaking with Vermont Law School professor Gus Speth.
As we move towards this transformation, one of the things that you say in the first part of your article is we must do everything we can to make the old system perform. How do you do that with such a broken system? What are the ways that we can work within our system as it exists now while we are building a new economy and a new set of systems?
Well, your premise is exactly right. We've got to walk on both feet, so to speak, both building something very different from what we have now, but also trying to make the current system work. And take the climate issue. I mean, long before we really will be able to accomplish these transformations in the nature of the corporation and our values and consumerism and our attitudes about growth and put in place a lot of deep changes in public policy that can salvage our politics and other things, we're going to have to deal with the climate issue. And we're going to have to deal with it with the situation that we know today, which includes a widespread climate denial and emissions that are taking us into very dangerous territory very soon, actually, according to the International Energy Agency and others. So the bottom line on these issues, like the climate issue, is that we really need to mobilize the public in a way that we're beginning to see happening. I was fortunate enough to be arrested in the District of Columbia protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, the tar sands pipeline, and spent 3 days in the D.C. jails. A minor incident. People are going to have to take the situation into their hands. And you see this happening with the efforts that Occupy and other protests and demonstrations that are occurring. I don't know how to move this system other than for people who understand the reality that we face to begin to express themselves in a very direct action kind of way. That, and I think it is sinking in now, that a lot of this global weirding that we've been having, these extreme events, which is, can be tracked, for example, in the cost to insurance companies, which has reached a pinnacle, that these developments are related to climate change, and they are precisely the kinds of things that are going to get worse with climate change. So hopefully we can make people have a sense of crisis, because we really do face one. The alternative is to put on our hands here, as we're doing now, and wait until something really disastrous befalls us, something that will force our hands.
So undergirding the actions that you're talking about on a practical level, you mentioned the importance of a theory of change, and you hit on one component of that, the sense of despair and the sense of coming to realize the crisis and multiple crises that we face. And then the flip side of that is the role of hope. Can you tell us how these two elements of despair and hope work together to create change?
Sure. Well, it's the old push me, pull you arrangement. We've talked about the push, so to speak, the need to escape the current calamities that are befalling us. The pull is the attractive future that is still within our power to build. And I've tried in the article in Orion and at greater length in my book to describe that future in which the country has pulled itself out of the basement that we're in now in terms of our peer countries. It's the future where we have recognized the reality of climate change and increasing energy and commodity prices and what that means for societies. It's the future that has shifted away from consumerism to more collaborative consumption and sharing, you know, in which we are pioneering the rapid development of new corporate forms and new business forms that are public-private hybrids and profit-not-for-profit hybrids. It's a future in which life is a lot more local. We've moved from globalization to localization. And, you know, we can still have that future for our grandchildren, my five grandchildren, for example. But we've got to move fast if we're going to get there because, you know, we're in a race, really, to reverse these negative consequences.
And you mentioned your grandchildren, and you also mentioned the role of love in this great transformation. How does love, it's something that seems so soft when it comes to the crises that we're facing. We often imagine something more fierce. But what role does love have to play in this?
Well, I think we all have it's easiest to have this level of deep affection for one's offspring and grandchildren and friends that we know. I think a lot about the future that they are going to have come mid-century, say, if we don't act. I mean, if we just let current trends continue, even with some modest improvements, the world in 2050 is going to be a pretty horrific place if we don't act. But that doesn't have to be. And if we really care for posterity, including our own, and the future of people on this planet, we have got to make some very dramatic changes. You know, as my friend Jack Gibbons, a former presidential science advisor, used to say, if we don't change direction, we're going to end up where we're headed. And right now, we're headed to some very nasty places. So I think, it's both sort of fear and love. It's fear of what we could be leaving for the future, and it's love for those that we care about and wanting to build a better world for them.
Well, Gus Speth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Satellites gone up to the sky. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I love to watch things on TV.
This is Alex Wise. Next on Sea Change Radio, Bill Bowie speaks with Will Rapp. Mr. Rapp is the founder of both Gardner's Supply, a company well known for its innovative business and socially responsible business practices, as well as Intervale Center, a community farming innovation center.
Will Rapp, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Now, Will, on your blog right now, you have a post that starts out with a chart from the World Wildlife Fund looking at our global ecological footprint, or how much resources we collectively as a world use, mapped against our biosphere's capacity, or how much resources there are and that can be used. And the graph shows that we're way overshooting. We're using too many resources. You do this in a post about the New Economics Institute and this upcoming conference on strategies for a new economy. What does resource use and overshoot have to do with creating a new economy?
Well, that whole idea of, I think that chart was, I don't know, over a 50 or 60 year period, I think. And during that period, the analysis started in the 1960s, where we were using a little over a half of the Earth's natural resources. You know, we're talking water, air, soil, forests, etc., to essentially produce the goods and services necessary to support human life on the planet. And some 20, 25 years later, we sort of continued our consumption, we continued our population growth, and then we hit a point where we were using the equivalent of all the Earth's resources. Now, obviously, some parts of the planet are using a lot less than other parts of the planet. But today, move fast forward another 30 years or whatever, and I think we are using an Earth and a half worth of resources. And if you were to do that analysis according to the lifestyle of, you know, Americans or Canadians or Australians or Germans, I don't know, it's four or five worth of Earths necessary to supply the natural resource base to make our goods and services. So how does that relate to creating a new economy and economics? We continue to fail in economic analysis to account for the use of our natural resource wealth, or in accounting terms, we're eating our balance sheet assets and treating them as if it were current income. And what is really frightening is that there is no mechanism to really embed in our economic systems the cost of consuming more natural resources. Therefore, since these are not, some are renewable, some are not, but they're certainly not renewable at the rate we're consuming them. So as we overconsume this wealth that has built up over millennia, we are depleting the capacity to essentially provide that same base of productivity going forward. So conventional economics, which I studied in college, sort of says, well, let's assume we've got infinite resources, essentially, and so growth does not have to accommodate the fact that we're depleting those resources. And so it works out its relationship with capital and labor, but not so much, you know, land and related resources. So the point that I was trying to make is there's a reckoning time coming where we will have a lot less water, a lot less air, a lot less soil, a lot less forest or minerals or petroleum or these other forms of natural wealth. And so it'll get more costly to run our economy the way we've done it. So at some point, we're going to have to start embedding into our economic systems and into the accounting related to them the cost of that depletion.
And this is all happening within the context of the economy and the capitalist system as it currently functions. And so what you're saying is that can't go on ad infinitum. How do we get from here to there?
A great question. You know, I've essentially spent my career trying to figure out how to do that, really at more of a what do I do in my backyard, what do I do in my community level. And I began 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago maybe, to think, well, we're not making progress at the pace we need it. If we're just talking about, you know, what we're doing in our homes and our communities, we're going to have to go to a larger scale. And I was really seeing, you know, the opportunity, you know, the reality that climate change was becoming appreciated by more people as a real barrier to our environmental well-being and therefore our economic well-being, and that we were going to make progress on that. So we saw the emergence of carbon markets in Europe. We were thinking when Obama was elected that there would be some progress, you know, to account for the impact of carbon emissions and therefore to create some incentives or disincentives around adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And, you know, I was greatly hopeful about that. I still am when the policy framework changes and supports that. But if we wait for a global policy network or even national one, I think we're going to wait a long time at this stage anyway, given that we had this economic collapse that we're all still trying to respond to and deal with. So my view has sort of been moving back to how do we have system change in this area of increased accountability for natural wealth and for investment and supporting businesses that restore or at least don't deplete natural wealth. And on that level, I think it needs to happen at the local, regional, state level. So that really is more where I'm putting my attention these days.
Money, it's a crime. Share it fairly, but don't take a slice of my pie. Money, so they say.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and you're listening to guest host Bill Bowie's conversation with Gardner Supply founder Will Rapp.
How can you create systems change from the bottom up as compared to from the top down?
Well, depends on what your container size is, right? I think there was a moment in time 4 or 5 years ago after Inconvenient Truth and certainly new awarenesses and questions being asked about our responsibility for drastically changing the global climate and having the negative effects of that, where there was a possibility of progress internationally and nationally. And there's an interesting graph that I've seen that I think Gallup did over the last 50 years. They asked people what's more important, environmental quality or economic growth. And so they charted public attitude about that. And, you know, it was up and down and up and down. But over most of the last 50 years, environmental well-being was important, whereas economic growth, you know, was considered to be, yes, important, but not quite as high a priority. Then we hit the dot-com bust in 2000, and that began to shift where the survey results said people were more anxious about economic growth. And then in 2008, it shifted totally so that economic growth became the priority over environmental health. So a lot of our policies are built upon the way the people who elect or sponsor governments act and behave. And so right now we're not in a very healthy place for economic growth to be diminished at all by environmental well-being or issues of sustainability. That's not true in some, you know, some places. So in Vermont, where I am, there, for whatever reasons, historic precedent and government is still small. You know, town meetings are still the major way decisions are made. There's still a high values context around, you know, what we encourage our political leaders to be thinking about. And because of that, we've been able to shift to asking questions about macro systems like the food system or like the energy system or like, you know, land use broadly, where policies at the state level can actually yield results which are not possible at the national level because of this conflict of, you know, economic well-being versus environmental health. So in Vermont, both are important. Economic well-being is going to be subservient in most cases to environmental health. Plus, we didn't get hit as hard by the recession Our unemployment rate was way below national average. Our housing default rate was way below national average. And this is partly because we don't have a boom and bust economy. We have an economy that's made up of, you know, mostly small businesses built on local economic systems. So they didn't get whipsawed. Our banks didn't make stupid loans. So you have this state-based economy that was willing to continue to address long-term thinking about things like the state of our farms or smart energy policy and economic reality where people's health, like, you know, we're moving to a single-payer health program here in Vermont where the universal health care, because we can sort of experiment on a smaller scale, because we still can have conversations about long-term issues, whereas I think that's very difficult in a lot of places.
So how do we take that kind of experimentation and that kind of grassroots, bottom-up systems change thinking and action and spread that more broadly and particularly influence the kind of top-down or more global big systems change that, you know, seem to be needed to create the kind of new economy that we are envisioning in this conference and, you know, through the work of the New Economics Institute more generally?
Well, yeah, that's part of what the conference is about, coming up with the best and smartest strategies to do that. What I do suspect is, I was talking earlier about that, you know, the public opinion about what's more important, you know, and when it's an either-or conversation, there's always going to be a win-lose answer. So somehow we have to get the conversation of economic well-being and environmental progress or social well-being as all the same thing, and that we can show how that happens with individual businesses. So the whole process of the new generation of businesses that are driven by triple bottom line, not just financial but also equity and environmental impact concerns, is certainly a way that's spreading broadly throughout the country at the private enterprise level. So I think we, you know, we're taking 150 years of industrialization and having to recognize there's some real fallacies and failures with it. How do we reinvent that system? We do it with little pockets that prove that's possible. We also do it with a different way of analyzing what success looks like at the top level. Really, to me, that's what this conference is hopefully all about, is recognizing that there's going to be a lot of change happening at the enterprise level or at the community level, as well as systems change, you know, whether it's state or national or beyond, and that we can come up with what those lever points are. The opportunity has never been greater for those levers to be activated, because, you know, every time there's an attempt to fix the economy, it seems like we are not proving the old model is effective and working. So the need for a new model, the appreciation for measuring things differently, has never been more ripe. How we actually do that, it's going to happen on an awful lot of fronts with a lot of organizations. And what New Economics Institute is trying to do is just provide a forum for a lot of the innovators to come forward and talk about what they're doing, and hopefully out of that will become a set of next steps that people can rally around.
Will Rapp, thank you so much for speaking with us, and looking forward to hearing what you have to say at the Strategies for a New Economy conference coming up in June.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Herbie Mann, U2, and Pink Floyd. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.